Okay, I can deal with it. Okay. There you go. Okay, hello everyone. Nice to see you all again. I haven't been here for a while, so if you haven't seen me before, that's the reason why that's the case. And it is not because I don't like the Armada Group. I actually really love the Armada Group. The reason I haven't been there is because Tuesday night at the monastery is a night when we do the monastic rules. And when we do the monastic rules, either you have to go stay there and do the monastic rules, or you come to the Armada Group. So I tend to be in charge of that. That's why I haven't been here. But I actually really like to come here, and it's one of the reasons I like to come here is because it has kind of a very nice feeling in here in the Armada Group. Very kind of friendly and very relaxed and at ease and informal and usually kind of a good atmosphere here. And this is actually one of those very fundamental and very important things for meditation practice to work out. If there is a sense of disharmony within a community or a family, or even in a monastery or wherever it might be, that disharmony always creates a massive damper on the meditation practice. If you want to have a success in meditation, you have to be able to feel at ease, to feel good, to feel relaxed, and all of these kind of things. It is so important. That is why it is wonderful that, you know, people like Rachel especially, has been able to keep a good atmosphere in this group for such a long time. It's a wonderful and very important thing here. And it brings us back to one very essential element that is so important on the Buddhist meditation and Buddhist practice, and that is the idea that it's supposed to be happy practice, right? You're supposed to enjoy. This is not torture. This is not some kind of self-flagellation or anything like that. You're supposed to enjoy what you're doing. This is kind of the idea behind this. And this is when you read the word of the Buddha, what is called the suttas or the discourses of the Buddha, this is one of those themes that you see again and again and again in these discourses. Everywhere he talks about happiness. Every stage of the path, the Buddhist path, is about happiness in one way or the other. And especially when it comes to meditation practice, there's no end. There's one word after the other, one more powerful than the other one, right? About happiness and kind of movement of happiness as part of the meditation practice. And this is, I think, very important for many reasons. First of all, it is very nice that we're on a spiritual path that's about happiness, right? I find that really great. And that's a reason enough, you know, for doing meditation practice. But actually, there's also another very important reason why happiness is so important in meditation. And you probably all heard about mindfulness, right? You can't barely open a newspaper these days without reading the word mindfulness somewhere. Somebody's talking about mindfulness almost too much sometimes, right? Buddhism is like almost like taking over the world in a sense when you read mindfulness everywhere. But these things actually come from Buddhism, right? Mindfulness, the Pali word is sati. Pali is pretty much the language that the Buddha used 2,500 years ago. And now it's been grabbed by the corporate world and all this other kind of interests around the world. It's very fascinating how these things actually work. And very rarely is the Buddha kind of, you know, put down as the originator of these kind of things. It's unfortunate. You have a little kind of saying by the Buddha at the bottom, reading the Wall Street Journal and by the Buddha. That'd be really cool, wouldn't it? that's where you find these kind of things. So the point here is that mindfulness is a very important part of the Buddhist path of meditation practice. And the question is, how do we give rise to this mindfulness? Mindfulness is really just the ability to be in the present moment, to be aware, right? Without thinking too much, without kind of being too deluded or too confused about what is going on. A kind of clarity about the present moment is really what mindfulness is all about. There's different ways of giving rise to the mindfulness. And one of the classical ways of giving rise to mindfulness is to use willpower, right? I'm going to be mindful. And you kind of grit your teeth and you clench your fists and you kind of give rise. Okay, I'm going to be in the present moment. I'm going to watch the breath, right? One, two, right? And after a while, you want to get out of here. You don't want anything more to do with the Armada Group for the rest of your life, right? This is what happens. Because it's so painful, right, when you have to kind of meditate in that way. So that's one way of giving rise to mindfulness, to kind of clench your fist and really try really hard and use willpower. But there is another way, and that is, of course, the way whereby the mindfulness comes naturally by itself. How does mindfulness arise naturally by itself? Well, it arises because you are happy, right? You are content. The present moment, as Ajahn Brahm likes to say, is the pleasant moment. And when the present moment becomes the pleasant moment, wow, it is so, you're so glad to be here. You don't want to be anywhere else. You don't want to think about the past. You don't want to fantasize about the future. You don't want to think about this or that. You just want to be here. So the idea is like almost like the happiness principle, the pleasure principle of the Buddhist path. If you are happy, if you are content, if you are enjoying yourself, then mindfulness tends to arise as a matter of course. You can't avoid being mindful. You want to be here. It's so, such a wonderful thing to be here. And that's why you actually, the sense of present moment awareness actually comes from that. So that's why the idea of happiness is so important on the Buddhist meditation practice. Not just happiness, but just a sense of ease and of relaxedness and all of these kind of things. And it informs so much of the idea of meditation practice once you get this right. So once you understand that being kind of content, not being too much pain and being kind of happy and with these kind of things, once you understand that's important, that tells you a lot about what you have to do. And the first thing it tells you is that you have to be comfortable, right? If you have pain in your knees, pain in the back, pain in your shoulders, whatever, it's going to be terrible. How are you going to find any happiness if you start off with pain in a meditation practice? And this is a big problem that many people face, and many people actually make a kind of a mistake about that. They think it's good to sit there with lots of pain in the body and these kind of things. And maybe it can be when you get very advanced. You can maybe get some insights into the idea of pain and these kind of things. But in the early stages of the meditation path, and 99% of people are in the early stages, because, you know, when I talk about the high stages, I mean really kind of up there, where you kind of, have you got your samadhi? Samadhi is like the stillness of the mind is very powerful. Then it's a different story here. But it actually takes very rare for people to actually get to those high stages, especially in ordinary daily life. So for that reason, what you have to do, instead of actually trying to kind of deal with the pain and watch the pain, is just to relax and be at ease. Find a nice posture for yourself. You can sit on the floor if you want to. We have some yogis over here sitting on the floor. That's really, really good. Yeah, so you can do that if you want to. But if you want to do that, then make sure that you are comfortable. And one of the nice ways of meditating is sometimes to change your posture. Sometimes sitting on a chair, sometimes on the floor, sometimes standing on your head, right? And other kind of postures. Actually, there was a monk who did that. He was standing on his head, and he got into some deep meditation while he was standing on his head, and he fell over. He had no idea what was going on, right? So, that's kind of weird. I wouldn't recommend that. That's a very advanced posture for meditation practice. Any posture is really okay. As long as you're able to kind of be comfortable, that is by far the most important thing here. So that is the basic thing. Please get these basic things right. If you get the basic things right, meditation is going to be something you can take with you for the rest of your life and be a very important part of your daily life, your spiritual practice, and all of these kind of things. Once you are comfortable, the second thing to do, you're physically comfortable, is to learn to relax, right? So you want to be physically comfortable, and you also want to be mentally comfortable. Mentality, the physical aspect and the mental aspect coming together. And one of the best ways of learning how to be mentally relaxed is actually, again, focusing on the physical body. So many of the things that we do in life, especially when we get stressed or there are problems in life, they have some kind of repercussion in the physical body. We can often feel the stress in the body, right? You all know what it's like. Your stomach gets tight, your shoulders get painful and all of these kind of things. So one of the great things for relaxing the mind is actually focusing on the physical body, and feel if you are really relaxed or not. And as you feel the body, and you have to be very patient with this, right? You come into this beautiful group with all these beautiful people around you, and then you just learn to relax. And you allow the day that has been to kind of fall, to kind of leave that behind. You don't think about the future, worry about anything. And you just enjoy the present moment. You just stay here and just learn to relax by focusing on the physical body. And it takes a while. One of the most important principles in meditation is just to be patient, just to allow things to kind of come, fall down, relax all by themselves. And things tend to relax by themselves if you allow them to be here. The reason why we can't relax is precisely because we're using our mind too much, using willpower, forcing our body in a certain way. So if you just sit back and wait, and you're able to really be very, very patient with yourself, what you find is that you start to relax automatically here. So this is always the beginning. Just allow yourself to relax as much as you can, just by waiting, by being patient. Right, being patient is so difficult, right? It's so hard sometimes to be patient. But it's also a wonderful thing when you get into this kind of timeless patience, where kind of time doesn't have much meaning anymore. You just kind of move along. You allow things to settle down, become more and more peaceful. It's a very beautiful and powerful thing to actually feel that inside of yourself. So be patient. And of course, one of the important other things about this is the attitude that you have, right? Attitude is so important in meditation practice. And first of all, the attitude that you have towards yourself. If you're going to relax, you have to feel quite good about yourself. Not perfect, because it's very hard to feel absolutely perfect, but at least have a kind of relatively good kind of self-image and feeling good about yourself. And I will give you some ideas during the guided meditation how to do that. The idea is kind of get into this positive mood, right? Feeling kind of happy about yourself. I'll talk maybe more about that after the meditation as well, because it's actually a very important part of the whole idea of Buddhist practice. And then when you do that, you calm down even more. And the final thing to do in meditation is not just the attitude that you have towards yourself, but the general attitude that you have towards life and you have towards other people and you have in general is also so important, right? Attitude is so fundamental. And when you have like a positive attitude, you have a sense of goodwill to the people around you, you feel kind of generally good about your life, all of these positive kind of things coming out of you, that is where meditation really starts to work. That's where it's possible to become calm. That's where it's possible to actually get something really out of this meditation. It's of course okay. I know that some people may feel a bit, you know, sometimes people feel depressed, right? Sometimes you have a bad day, you can, whatever it is, and you're not really happy about things. That's okay too. But what we have to learn then, we have to learn to kind of try to deal with that mind in such a way that we can abandon as much of the negative states as possible and move over in a positive way. And that's why it is so great to come to such a welcoming Amrita group, right? Where people are friendly, people are kind, people are at ease and relaxed. It is so important because that makes you feel at ease. You kind of the right attitude gets forced onto you, right? Even if you don't want the right attitude, you have to have it after a while, because this group is so powerful in kind of inculcating that positive attitude into you, right? So this is how it works. This is how it all kind of comes together in a nice way. Okay, so let us try this out in practice and see what happens. So we'll try to do about half an hour's meditation or so. So let's see what comes out of this. Okay, so sit nicely on your chair or on the floor or wherever you are, and just lean back on your seat very gently. Sit quite straight with the body, both of your legs kind of firmly planted on the floor, and your hands in your lap. Close your eyes. As you close your eyes, you're shutting out so much of the world, which is a great thing. It means you can really feel the body properly. You can see what is going on in a much better way. So just start off, once your eyes are closed, by feeling the body. Making sure, first of all, that you are nice and comfortable. You want to be able to sit for about half an hour or so. The ideal thing is to sit roughly still for half an hour, but of course if you do have any pains anywhere, any major problems, please feel free to move at any time. And then start off your meditation by just feeling the body. And now the idea, just to feel if you have any tensions anywhere, any pains anywhere, any problems of any kind. And the idea here is to release those tensions and release those problems in the body. Just give yourself time, be patient with this. One very simple technique to start off with, just if you feel tension in the stomach, for example, or wherever it is, take a few deep breaths. And as you take the deep breath, when you allow the breath to go out again, just relax 100% as you do that. And please just stay with the body for now and just have a general awareness of the body, no particular point, just a general awareness. And wherever you feel that there is a problem, a tightness, a pain or whatever, that is really what you have to deal with first of all. Get into this space where you feel really relaxed and at ease. So just imagine yourself if you have a pain somewhere or a tightness somewhere. Imagine yourself breathing in through that part of the body. And as you breathe in, you allow everything to expand. And as you breathe out, you allow everything to relax as a consequence. And just keep on staying with the body here. It is so important to take all the time you need at the beginning of the meditation just to relax as much as you possibly can. Don't try to force the relaxation. Just stand back and be patient. Allow things to become calm and peaceful and relaxed by themselves. All you have to do is just to observe. Observe and then have some very gentle ideas towards yourself. For example, if you have a tightness somewhere, put your mind on that area with a kind of gentle and caring attitude. And as you do that, things tend to resolve themselves. And as you keep on focusing on the body, make sure that your awareness is very light. You have a very light touch with your awareness. Use no force, just a general feeling of the body overall. and make sure that you have a positive awareness of yourself. One of the ways of doing this is to think of yourself or your body as your little child. And with a little child, to make a little child hush, you have to be so gentle and so patient. You have to be so caring and kind. And it's exactly the same with your body. Have that sense of your body being your little child. This is a wonderful way of giving rise to the right perception, to patience, kindness, and care. And as you are relaxing in your meditation practice, make sure that you enjoy every stage on the path. Just feel how nice it is to sit there completely relaxed, with nothing to do in the whole world, apart from relaxing and being quiet. There's something very beautiful and powerful about that. And make sure you don't miss out on that power and that beauty, because this is what in part makes this path such a wonderful thing. And even if this is all you do in your meditation, this is still worthwhile. And as you do this, you find that sometimes you feel tired or the mind becomes very active. If that happens, don't do anything. Just allow these things to be. Stand back and observe them like a passenger, as if these things are just interesting phenomena passing through your mind. There's nothing for you to do except being a passive observer, and taking the relaxation even further if you can. And as you do this, make sure that you are leaning with the attitude in the right direction. And to help yourself, there are some simple things you can do. And one of those things is simply to be aware of what a wonderful thing it is that there are such things as meditation groups here in Armidale in this world. It is actually very difficult to find these kind of meditation groups, and how fortunate each one of us is to be able to take part of something like this, which is so hard to find in this world, with like-minded people in a kind and compassionate place. What a wonderful thing that is. And really indulge in that thought, how fortunate you are to take part in this, and get a sense of happiness out of that. And that is what I mean by right attitude. And as you do that, see how that correlates with the mindfulness, how the mindfulness and the presence of the mind become strong when you're really enjoying what you're doing right now. And we are now coming close to the end of the meditation. But before we come to the end, just ask yourself how you feel now. And if you feel more relaxed than at ease, if you feel more peaceful than we started out, then ask yourself why that is the case. What are the perceptions that you have given rise to? What are the things that you have let go of on the way? Try to understand the process of the meditation practice. Okay, that's it. Please come out. Okay. Okay, so content, happy, unhappy, miserable, yeah, uncertain. Does anybody have any questions they would like to ask, any comments they want to make, anything like that? There's always some standard problems that people have in meditation practice. Sometimes they fall asleep, right?
Yes.
It's one of those. Yes, okay. Is that a question or is it?
Not today.
Not today. Wow, okay, that's really good. So it's, today was better than usual, is that right?
Very quickly.
Yes. Okay, that's great. Okay, question. Okay, very good. Yeah. One of the things, sleepiness is very common because when you come here in the evening to the Amda group, you just finished a long day, right? Many of you maybe been to work or you had all kind of chores to do. And of course, then when you relax, all those things tend to come back to you and they kind of, you feel tired, right? You're supposed to relax and you kind of fall asleep instead. So it's natural. It's very natural that it happens. So if you fall asleep, enjoy the sleepiness, right? And just, that's okay. And relax with that. Because if we try to fight the sleepiness, usually we end up making it worse. So don't worry too much about those things. And instead, just learn to enjoy whatever you're doing here. That's kind of the idea behind this. Anyone have any comments on the meditation practice? Everybody's so completely happy, there's nothing to be said at all. Wow, that is really good. Pretty. Okay. Everyone else okay? You sure? Yeah, I don't want to ask some stupid questions. It's great to ask stupid questions, you know. Everybody thinks, oh, my question is so basic and so stupid, I don't really want to ask my question here. But it's okay, because probably if one person has that kind of question, probably many people have it, you know. That's usually the way it is. So don't be afraid of asking stupid questions. Stupid questions are usually good questions. Ah, one of the back there. Steve, okay. Go for it.
You could start trying to sort of soothe any tension in your body. And it goes away in one area and pops up in another.
Yeah.
Can you say something about that, please?
Yeah. It tends to, not only does it go away in one area, pop up in another, but it comes back again often in the same area as well, because your attention, you lose your attention, you drift into some fantasy or something, and then things come back again. So you just stay with it, keep on at it, basically. Follow the problem wherever it goes. And as you do that, things tend to calm down. One of the things there is what you're trying to do is many things in a sense at the same time. You're trying to enjoy the positive aspect of the experience, and you're trying to deal with the negative things. And when those things come together, in a sense, often they get a certain power, and your awareness strengthens as a consequence. So it's a gradual thing. It tends to kind of work together in that sense. Okay. Yes, at the back there. Yeah.
I find I have the same. You focus on one part that's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You focus, try and focus on your breathing and not on your thoughts.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I realize I'm not focusing on my breathing. I'm onto another thought about something else.
Yeah.
And then I go back. I bring myself back. Is that just practice to keep you going? It's going to improve or?
Yeah, I personally think that, you know, watching the breath is actually a very hard thing to do. It's quite a difficult part of the difficult thing in meditation practice. And when you read what the Buddha says about that, he always says that you should really establish mindfulness before you do any kind of meditation practice as such. And this is why, you know, like now, all I do is just focus on the idea of mindfulness, of being aware of what's going on without being aware of anything in particular. Because you want that mindfulness, the sense of presence, to be very powerful before you guide that sense of presence to the breath or to loving kindness or whatever it is. So even if you just use the whole time just to relax and be at ease and just learn to be an observer in life. One of the most problematic things with thinking is that we get carried away by the stream of thought. We're kind of part of the stream, right? This is one of the problems. So you learn instead to extract yourself a little bit from that stream, to stand back and be able to watch what is going on. This actually is a very important thing. And once you're able to be the observer, once you gain that distance from the object and yourself, you're kind of standing back and you're watching something at a distance. Once you do that, then you can actually start watching things like the breath. because you need that distance to be able to relax with something. If you are kind of merged with something, completely one with something, then you will be using willpower, and all kind of problems will arise as a consequence. You can try to watch the breath a little bit, but more important is actually to give rise to the sense of mindfulness and kind of just be at ease and be happy and feel a sense of pleasure with the present moment. That's by far the most important thing here. So sometimes if you start watching the breath too early, you end up using willpower. It's a problem many people have. And when you use willpower, the breath becomes uncomfortable. When the breath is uncomfortable, it's often a waste of time, the whole thing here. Yeah, it becomes very hard to do. Is that helpful at all, or?
Yeah, I think you're happy listening to your brain, because you do it all the time, but it's just that constant chatter.
Yeah.
It's almost like trying to listen to the breath and take away from that pleasure of just listening to the whatever story it is
going
through your head.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of the things that you actually want to find the happiness somewhere else. You want to find a kind of deeper sense of happiness, it's quite right what you're saying. The reason why you're doing it is because you enjoy it, right? You're kind of going along with the storyline or whatever it is. It's quite kind of pleasurable in a sense. But there are pleasures in meditation. Just the ability to be aware in the present moment is actually far more pleasurable than thinking once you get used to it. This ability just to be still, right? The thinking mind is almost like a bit like an irritation in the mind, in a sense. The willpower always driving this thing on. And once that stops, you're just aware, wow, it's actually very, very nice and very pleasurable. Just the old habits driving you on, the old kind of thoughts moving on in your mind. So you just have to be very patient with yourself, allow these things to disappear. Yes, sir. Who's first? many people first. Okay. Yeah.
So I had a question since I've been coming, I think.
How long have you been coming here?
I don't know.
No?
3 months or something.
Okay, 3 times. Okay. That's not too bad then.
Either we try. When they get up and say the announcements and stuff, it says we have monks guiding us 9 months of the year.
Yeah.
What happens the other 3 months?
Okay. That's a fair question, actually. We are actually on retreat for the last 3 months. We are on retreat, just doing meditation practice.
So what do we have here? We don't do it?
No, we have it every Tuesday, all year, and
so
other people teach.
Yeah.
Other people. Depends who we get.
And if you stay long enough, it might be you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I started off just like you.
That's great.
Thank you.
One of you had a question over there?
No, we're all.
You're all okay, all going ahead. Okay, very good. Yes, at the back there, yeah.
How it changes perception over time.
Well, it changes, I think, one of the most important things, it changes the perception of where you find happiness in life, right? What you consider happy, what you consider to be suffering or problematic. Because normally we have certain ideas of what happiness is. We think maybe thinking about things is happiness, or we think that certain indulgences are happiness. And over time, as you start to find, you start to look at these things differently, and you start to realize that actually, the peace and quiet you can find in meditation, for example, is a very powerful and beautiful happiness. You find that the happiness that you get out of being kind and compassionate to people actually is very powerful and beautiful, and often far better and far more pure than the ordinary kind of happiness that you find in ordinary life. So this is one of the changes that you see. You can see that your attitude towards things actually changes as time goes by. That's probably one of the most important things that changes. So that means you attach less to certain things, but you attach to other things instead. You attach to being kind, right? Whoa. That's the way to go, you see. Okay. Anyone else have anything to say?
So,
yeah, please. Yes, great.
Happiness is peace of mind.
Happiness is anything that is preferable to something else.
I wanted to know what is it.
It's a very good question. I think it's a very important one. But happiness is really anything which is preferable to something else, right? So when you meditate, there can be so many different things. Just feeling peaceful can be happiness. Feeling a sense of ease and relaxedness in the body is a kind of happiness, right? So wherever you have a preferable state is happiness in one way or another. But there are many different types of happiness. You know, in ordinary life, we talk about ordinary sensory happiness, the happiness of eating, for example, right? So that's one kind of happiness. But in meditation, obviously, trying to move away from those sensory kind of happiness towards an inner, more kind of spiritual type of happiness instead. So wherever you find happiness in life, that is what we call happiness, a very broad kind of spectrum. So, but it also includes things like, you know, when you, if your meditation is going really well and you're really relaxing, you're really enjoying yourself, sometimes you get joy coming up in the mind, right? Kind of joyful states. Whoa. And you feel the joy, you think, wow, this is really, now you start to really understand what meditation is about.
So you call that happiness.
That is also happiness, yeah.
Because so I thought happiness so many was things. Ha-ha or something.
Yeah, well, that's also happiness, right? Ha-ha is also happiness, yeah. That's why you have Ajahn Brahm here, face. Otherwise, Ajahn Brahm wouldn't be coming here, so ha-ha is happiness as well. So everything is, there's so many different types of happiness, but we have to kind of grade them a little bit, find out the more important ones.
I suppose each one has a different happiness, like I can be happy for something else, she might not.
Yeah.
Not the same, so yeah. Okay.
Indeed, but the most important thing is to divide things into what you might call spiritual happiness on the one hand, and worldly happiness on the other hand. And it's the spiritual happiness we're trying to kind of move towards here.
It's more peaceful, the spiritual happiness.
More peaceful, it's joyful in a positive sense. It's joyful in the sense that you think, wow, I've been living my life really well. I've been keeping the five precepts. I've been kind of being kind and generous. Whoa, what a wonderful thing that is. That kind of happiness, right? You feel happy about the way you live your life. It's a very important part of the Buddhist path.
That's lovely.
Yeah, great.
I've got a question.
Yes, please.
The Buddha has told that we should be able to do the metta meditation yourself first.
Yeah.
I cannot do that.
Yeah.
I can do it to others.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's okay. It's fine. You don't have to do it towards yourself, right? So what you this is one of those actually quite interesting things. This is getting quite technical now. We're going to be this tiny little bit technical for just now. So one of that idea of having metta for yourself. Metta, by the way, means loving kindness, or it means like goodwill or friendliness or something like that. For those of you who don't know the Pali word, this idea of having metta or loving kindness for yourself actually comes not from the Buddha, it comes from a later part of the Buddhist teachings. This actually is very interesting. It comes from, are you from Sri Lanka background? Okay, so it comes from the Visuddhimagga. You know the Visuddhimagga?
Yeah.
One of those very important kind of works in the Theravada tradition, right? That's actually where it comes from. When you read the suttas and you read them in the what I think is the right way, right? this is getting very difficult. This is actually very technical. I'm not going to go into all the details. But as far as I can see, there's no reference to that in the suttas, in the word of the Buddha whatsoever. In the word of the Buddha, the idea is always to spread the metta out to the whole world, to all beings. But of course, the point is that if you do spread it out to all beings, you are included, right? Because you are a being too. You don't actually have to focus on yourself specifically, you can just focus on the whole world, and as you do that, you are included by default.
Because I thought normally I used to get the person get angry quickly, used to have, so I thought that's the problem with me.
Yeah.
Instead, I get angry quickly with my kids.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Not like early days.
Yeah.
I thought that's the problem because I'm a kind of angry person, that's why. Loving kindness towards myself.
Great, no, that's good. You can do towards it, but it doesn't really matter so much because if you're able to have loving kindness towards others, you're usually able to have it towards yourself as well. Usually these things go together. So whatever works is really the most important thing. If you can't do it towards yourself, don't stop. That's fine. Stop doing it. And I think one of the other things that people often forget about when it comes to the idea of metta and loving kindness and these things, that actually, before we even try to do it in meditation, it's so important that we do it through action and speech, first of all. And also the way you think about people in daily life, right? Watch your mind in daily life and see how it actually works. Are you critical? Are you easily upset about things in daily life? And that is where a large part of the work is to be found. How can you deal with the mind in daily life? How can you move it towards more acceptance, more friendliness, more understanding, more compassion, right? Rather than being critical and fault-finding and all these kind of things. And actually, if you really want to do that, it's actually not that hard. It's actually possible to move the mind fairly quickly. Well, at least over a few years, if you wish. That's quite quick, right? And then move it towards a different way, an attitude towards other people. And one of the very basic things that I find extremely useful to do that is to remember the Buddhist teaching of non-self, anatta, right? Anatta basically means that people are conditioned to be what they are. So when people act in certain ways, not because they want to be like that, it's because they're acting out their conditioning here, right? They have a certain personality formed in the past, through the growing up, through the parents, through the school, through past lives, right? According to Buddhist teachings, all of these things coming together. And because all of these things come together in the present moment, they act in a certain way. Yeah. And once you understand that people are, in a sense, a victim of their conditioning, a victim of their personality, a victim of their habits, a victim of all of these kind of things, then the forgiveness becomes actually relatively easy. You can let go of those things, and you can think about them instead with a sense of compassion and kindness instead. So that's a very brief, but this is actually a very important part, I think, of the Buddhist teaching, this idea of moving the mind away from those negative states towards something positive. And then when all of those things come together, the kindness in body and speech, the kindness in the way you think about people, that's when it becomes possible in meditation practice to have a sense of metta.
Is it a forget about the people action, or is it accepting?
It's accepting it, because you understand why they do what they do. If you forget about it, it's too difficult. You have to learn to accept those things. This is the way they are. Yeah. Yeah. Good luck. Okay. It takes a while, right? So just keep on going. You'll be fine. Yeah. Okay, Rachel. Yeah.
So where did the myth come from then, that we're supposed to do it to ourselves first and then others?
This is from the Visuddhimagga.
We've been taught. So
have
often,
you? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because this is the standard, this is the default where everybody teaches, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But as far as I can see, there's no reference to that in the suttas. Actually, what the Buddha says, this is quite interesting. This, you know, do you know the suttas at all?
I know some of them. Yeah.
Okay, so this is the simile of the saw.
Yeah.
You know the simile of the saw, right? So this is Majjhimanikaya number 21, middle length sayings of the Buddha, sutta number, discourse number 21. And in there, he says that if somebody is speaking to you and they speak to you in the wrong way or whatever it is, the first person who should have metta towards is that person.
Mm.
Right? And that is very contrary to what you're used to training. Because you're always taught, start off with the kind of friendly person or whatever. Here he says, start off with the one that actually having problems with. And there is many ways of explaining that. One way is that these people are already pretty advanced in the practice, right? So you start off with the most difficult one. But I think one other reason is that, as you know, if you really practice the Buddhist path properly, you don't really have any enemies anymore, right? You kind of try to avoid this whole idea of having any enemies. So if somebody kind of suddenly arises as a potential enemy, you deal with that straight away before it kind of gets anywhere and kind of blocks you, right? And then you get that out of the way, you're finished with that, and then the meditation is possible, because no more enmity anywhere at all. I think this is the kind of probably what lies behind that. So so it is very different. Sometimes I read these scholarly papers. There's one of my monastic friends called Venerable Anali, who's a German monk who writes all these scholarly papers on things. He's also a very good meditator, by the way. And he analyzed this one word in the Pali, which is the source for this idea that, you know, you have metta towards yourself, first of all. But he analyzed it in such a way, which I thought was very convincing the way he did that. He compared it with suttas in different languages and all kinds of things, and he came to a very powerful conclusion. Doesn't mean that at all, and the whole thing is actually based on a misunderstanding here. Mm-hmm. And very interesting. So I was certainly convinced. Ajahn Sujata was convinced when he read it, so it was actually a very good argument, actually.
Okay.
So, but anyway, I'm not going to go into details with that one, because it gets too much. Yes, sorry, I was
I just wonder, meditation that's good for concentration, I mean, when you're not meditating, does it improve concentration?
Yes, it does. All the things that we're doing here is meditation that eventually leads to concentration, if you like. But the problem with the word concentration is that very often when we talk about concentration language, we mean a certain force of the mind. You're forcing your mind onto what you have to read or what you have to write or whatever.
Listening to people.
Yeah, so concentration is good if it's a relaxed kind of concentration. If you're kind of just sitting back and you are aware of what's going on and you're focusing on what's happening, that is a good kind of concentration. But the concentration where you're forcing yourself to do things, that's kind of the things we're trying to avoid here. Do you see the, understand the difference?
Yeah?
It's like when you have to, you know, you go to work and you have to read kind of a manual or something really boring, right? You have to force yourself to read that manual. Afterwards, you feel a bit tired because you have been forcing yourself. So here the idea is the opposite. The idea is that you enjoy what you're doing. And when you enjoy what you're doing, your mind goes to that place automatically. So enjoy the present moment. Your mind hangs out in the present moment. Yeah? That's the difference there. That's kind of the idea. Anyway. Yes?
So you know ideally,
you want to use as little willpower as possible, because that will, one of the things that we want to do in meditation is to rest the mind. You want the mind to be at ease and relaxed and all of these kind of things. And if you use willpower, you're actually using up the energy of the mind. You're not really resting it properly. So you want to kind of just stand back, allow things to be. But one of the things I was saying during the meditation was the idea to be the passive observer, right? The passive observer is the exact opposite of using willpower. If you can really be completely passive, there's no willpower at all going on anymore. You're really kind of just standing back, right? Being aware, like a passenger or whatever. Yeah? That's kind of the idea there. Whoa, you're talkative a lot, aren't you? That's great.
Not
that's
usually.
That's wonderful. It's really good, actually.
Oh,
not really.
Question then.
Yeah. one more question. Okay,
well, you said that you don't come on Tuesday nights because you're doing the rules with the monks. I'm sure people would love to know something about that. Because I talk to mention them to people and they go, oh, I had no idea about anything.
Anything
like
about the monastic rules?
Yeah.
Okay, you know about the five precepts, is that right?
Yes.
Is everybody? Okay.
Well, not everybody.
Not everybody. Okay, but five precepts are kind of the basic Buddhist morality, right? Not to kill, not to steal, not to commit adultery or any kind of other kind of sexual bad things, and not to lie and not to take intoxicants. These are kind of the basic five precepts. And the monastic rules, that's basically what they are too, right? It's very, very similar to that. Very similar, but expanded a bit more. But otherwise, very, very similar to that. So instead of having kind of no sexual misconduct as a monastic, you have no sexual conduct at all, basically. That's kind of taking it slightly further. That's one of the very important ones. And one of the other very important rules, of course, is the idea we don't use any money as monastics, right? No money at all. So this is actually it's actually incredibly nice to live a life without money. Wow, this is so cool. You just and what is it? And what is really nice about it is people are so kind everywhere, right? They always come to you, they always want to support you, they always want to, wherever you are traveling in the world, people are so kind. And they take you around and they kind of do whatever. And it's a wonderful system, actually. And if they think about that in the right way, you know, that they are supporting a monastic or whatever, they get a certain happiness out of that, right? And you, at the same time, you can practice your rules and practice things in the right way. So you get happiness as well. It's kind of a win-win situation.
When you travel, when you travel interstate, you travel with the bag and
That's it.
And your bowl.
Yeah, that's it.
And that's it.
That's it. That's all.
Who brings your luggage?
don't need any luggage, right? This is a nice thing here. Nothing to bring here. Yeah.
On the plane, off you go.
Yeah, exactly.
One to down the steps at the other end.
Yeah, I always have just carry on. You know, that's really very, very handy.
No money at all.
which actually is very, very nice. It's so nice to live a life without money. One of the nice things about that is that you, after a while, you can get used to accepting what people give you. So when you get certain food, you accept that. When you give a certain robe, well, actually, we don't have much choice anyway, but when you get slightly different colors or whatever, you accept what you get, basically. And there's something very beautiful about that, because you tend to become very content with things. Right, you stop demanding, because you know you can't really demand anyway. You just have to accept what you get. There's something very nice about that, where kind of desires and the thinking about worldly things kind of tends to die down in a very nice way. So not having money is actually great. I really recommend that. That's one of the wonderful things about living the monastic life, actually.
Somebody gotta pay the bills.
So, yeah, that's true, actually. Yes, yeah.
Listening to Ajahn Brahm's podcast, and he is mentioning that monks only eat in the morning.
Yeah.
But then he was saying, but there's things that you can eat after lunch.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there's kind of minor things. At the time of the Buddha, there was some monastics who were ill. They had kind of sickness and things, so they're kind of getting really thin and really pale, and the veins kind of standing out on their bodies and this kind of stuff. And so the Buddha thought, what can I give them that is not really kind of solid food, but kind of is acceptable to eat? So they said there were certain things like oil and sugar and honey and some few things like that that you're actually allowed to eat in the afternoon.
That's
Yeah,
cheese.
Yeah, but it's not. You can't really make what cheese. Yeah, cheese is kind of it's kind of slightly grayish area.
Yeah.
So, but that is quite that is fairly substantial. But even with cheese, there's a limit to how much you can have. You know, we don't have that down monastery, by the way. We just have the other things. So you know, honey. You can only have so much honey, right? Before you start feeling sick. Okay.
What about things like tea and coffee?
Tea, coffee, have as much as you want. Okay. Tea, coffee, no problems. Yeah, yeah.
some religions think of this as intoxicating because it has caffeine and you're dependent on the cup of tea at 4 o'clock. So if you don't have it,
If you're in trouble, I think Ajahn Brahm might be in trouble if he didn't have his cup of tea. he loves his tea. He's English. Yeah, he's kind of born with tea. Exactly. Yeah, that's true.
A cup of tea in his hand. Yeah.
But I think the point here about it has to be intoxicating in the sense that it affects your mind, right? So your mind, you lose your mindfulness, you lose your ability to see clearly. That's the important thing. If it just gives a bit of energy, it's not really an issue. Huh? Who was next? Okay. Yeah, we have people coming to the monastery every day here. We have about 30 or 40 people every day coming to the monastery, right? And they just bring they drive all the way from Perth. Some of them live in Armidale, some of them live all the way in Perth, drive all the way to the monastery here, right? Usually come every week, and they and the reason why that happens is very much part of the Asian tradition. So a lot of those people have Asian background, because this is what they're used to from Asia. Come to the monastery, hang out with the monks for a while, have a chat and all of these kind of things, and then give some, you know, give food at the same time.
That sounds like a good deal.
It's an excellent deal, yeah.
What sort of food?
Yeah. Wow, the best cuisine in Perth, isn't it? It's pretty close. Like a bit of Thai food, a bit of Chinese food, a bit of kind of Western food. Yeah. So yeah, it's actually very, 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 very good quality food. Huh? I think people like to kind of do their best for the monks, right?
Yeah.
It may sound that sounds kind of that's the way it usually works, actually. Huh? Yeah. Basically, that's what it comes down to. Yeah. Yeah.
I've seen a TV program once, and these monks were passing by with a bowl, and the lady was putting one spoon of rice in every.
Yeah.
Is that how it is?
That is the traditional way. That is called pindapat. That is kind of going an arms round, and that's a traditional way of getting your food in Asia. So what you do, you start out at your monastery in the morning, you go into the local village, and you have your bowl with you, and the people put food in your bowl.
Yeah.
You go back to your monastery, and you have your meal afterwards. But we can't do that here because it's too far to walk from Armidale to Serpentine. We're in serious trouble. So
they used to do it in Armidale.
That's true. They drove in and then we go. That's right. Yeah. So, but yes, please. Yeah.
Going back to the questions around concentration and effort and during the meditation, how do you describe? What is it that when we notice the mind's wandering that we make a decision or exercise some choice to bring it back?
You
name that?
Well, There is some degree of will in that, of course, but you don't actually have to use any will there, because the moment you are aware that the mind is wandering, you are already mindful, basically, right? At that moment, what you can do is just wait and keep on waiting, keep on watching what's going on, and as you watch the wandering mind, it dies down very, very quickly if there's a little bit of mindfulness there. And it kind of disappears by itself, and you're back again in the present moment. So there's very little that you actually have to do. Just awareness is often enough. Please, yeah.
We've heard a lot about the benefits on the body and everything, and all the scientific studies of how good meditation is.
Yeah.
Has there been any studies about prevention of diseases like Alzheimer's?
Rachel on the brain?
Rachel is nodding. You know about this, Rachel? Yeah.
Yeah. There's some research that over time, particularly in women, that the grey matter in the brain increases, which is what you want as an anti-dementia thing. It's considered as an anti-aging. I don't know if there's specific dementia research, but definitely thickening of the grey matter.
Yeah. Okay. So there you are. That's good. Excellent.
With not using money.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how hard and fast the rule that is.
Yeah.
Because for practical purposes, if you say arrive at an airport and there's some considerable delay and the people picking you up haven't arrived, would it be acceptable to just borrow 50 cents off somebody?
That
would be all right.
I've never actually. I've been a monk for 20 years. I never actually needed to use money for those 20 years at all. So it's amazing how things tend to work out. You know, it's remarkable.
Almost always works out. Would you feel inhibited from doing that?
If it was a desperate situation, I probably would. If it was really desperate, because it's after all, it's a pretty minor thing. You're not really breaking any moral. You're not killing anyone, right?
No.
So it's
So you need to use telephones.
Yeah, yeah. But
you haven't had to. I don't know if you use mobiles or not.
Don't even have a mobile phone. So it's actually very nice. Yeah. But usually there's a ways around these things. You know, when you come to the airport, you go to somebody. You say you're a Buddhist monk. I don't have any money. Would you be able to help me? You go to the kind of the information counter or whatever, and people are usually very helpful. Usually it happens. So usually it's actually okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable when people see you like this, they realize there's something about you is a bit unusual, right? So it sort of works out one way or the other. Yeah.
Actually, if you're a bit naughty, you can use that as a travelling knife.
As a what?
Don't be a monk. Buy the outfit, not the knife. There's a lot of stories about it.
Yeah, I think some people do that, actually.
It's happened.
It's happened.
Have a little pet dog with you, no?
Well, when you say that people bring food on a daily basis, is it already prepared or is it food to cook?
They usually bring prepared food. Put it on the table, and then we kind of serve ourselves, and then we that's usually how it works. They also bring food to cook as well. It's a bit of both. So being a monk is really it's really nice. You are a recipient of so much kindness, and you try also to reciprocate, right? You try to be kind in return as well. So it kind of goes both ways, and it's a very beautiful lifestyle actually. Highly recommended. No pressure. Yes.
Yeah, small question. Going back to one of the five processes, the molecules, what would you do if there's lots of caterpillars in the garden, like veggie garden?
Okay.
Now, Asian countries, like for this, they grow their own food, they grow veggies and like rice. What
can you do? Well, it depends on the situation, right? It depends on kind of what the exact situation is. But if you are, if you are dependent on your livelihood, for example, on vegetables because you sell that to in the marketplace or whatever, then of course you're going to have to deal with those caterpillars one way or the other. And you try to find a humane way or a caterpillarian way of dealing with them, so they don't actually have to kill them. You try maybe to throw them into the forest or something like that, but they usually come back. That's exactly the problem. So you try your very best to deal with this in a good way, if you possibly can. And if it turns out to be impossible, and you know you're going to starve to death or whatever if you don't kind of do something about it. There may come a point when you have to, you may have to kill those caterpillars. It's possible. You can't. These rules are training rules. They are there for you to kind of be a red light to be careful. So you are as careful as you possibly can. But in very difficult situations, sometimes we have to kind of do those kind of things. It happens even in monasteries sometimes. I know many monasteries have had to do similar kind of things. For example, you have cockroaches in the kitchen. And the local shire council says, we're going to shut down the monastery unless you do something about the cockroaches. Right? That kind of situation. So what are you going to do? Sometimes it's almost as if there is no way out of these things. But the important point here is to remember that When you kill a living being, it tends to have a negative effect on your mind, and that's why you want to be as careful as possible to try to find another way of dealing with it. If you can avoid it, you should avoid it, and if you really, really can't, well, you're also minimizing the negative effect of what you're doing anyway, so it's not as bad as it would otherwise be. So because you've tried your very best to avoid those things.
Yeah, when I kill capitalists,
it doesn't affect your meditation. Okay, but
alternative way, I put caterpillars in a plastic bag and feed them with like green leaves and throw them in the bin, but still another way, indirectly kill them.
Okay.
Still, like, the intention wasn't good from my point of view.
Okay, well, you had to be careful because to actually know whether it affects the meditation, it can actually be quite difficult to know. It depends on how deep your meditation is and all of these kind of things. If your mind is very, very pure and very, very bright, then you can see much more clearly what actually affects the mind. So it depends how deep your meditation is. If you are really blissed out and you have a very powerful mind, you're able to see tiny little smudges on the mind if you do something which isn't quite right. Right, so be careful. This is why I'm saying that sometimes it's actually hard to know these particular things. So it's more important. It's actually quite useful to be rather be safe than sorry if you possibly can. But try to avoid those things. So I know that I've done even some of the great, teachers in Buddhism, like Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher from Thailand. And he had a disciple who came to him and said, I'm a fisherman and I rely on fishing for a living. What should I do? And as I told him, well, you have to continue, because you're a fisherman. If you don't fish, you're not going to make a living, your kids are going to suffer, all these kind of things. So you have to continue. And in the meantime, as you continue, you try to find another livelihood as you do that. Try to find another way of dealing with these things. So always be on the outlook. Remember that every little being wants to live. They want to live, right? The caterpillars don't want to die. They want to live themselves, just like you want to live. So because they want to live, you try your very best to find a way they actually can live, so they can be more happy as well. So this is kind of the balance here between these things.
Now I am responsible for the happiness of caterpillars.
Are you? Wow, yeah, okay.
You are.
Good, That's great,
Not to mention the snails.
Well, that is caterpillars. Yes, it's terrible. What they cause is too much damage.
Too much damage, yeah.
So they are not mindful.
They're not mindful. No, I don't think you should expect that, actually.
Yeah,
asking too much. Okay. Yeah.